Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to the world's longest running football fans podcast from CelticUnderground.net. If you like what you hear today, you can subscribe at iTunes. And you can download or listen at a variety of places where I'm sure you can also subscribe. And these are SoundCloud, Audioboom, Spreaker and YouTube. And of course, the website, CelticUnderground.net. This week's podcast a wee bit different. 10 days or so ago, there was an evening in the Admiral Bar with three authors. Well, it was actually four authors. Miss Paul Cuddy was also there. But it was mainly a Q&A session and discussion with Paul Dykes, who wrote The Quality Street Gang, our own Stephen Murray with 10 Men Won the League, and Stephen Sullivan, author of Celtic's Iron Man, the biography of Sean Fallon. And they discussed all things Celtic. This is the first part. It's in two parts, this podcast. So I hope you enjoy. Meantime, I've just come back from the game last night, or tonight even. By the time you're listening to it, it'll be last night. And bar a ridiculous decision by Armstrong to do a short corner to Scott Allen when he was in a defensive position, I thought the 4-1-4-1, which then changed to 4-4-1-1, worked well. And I thought the young players worked well, played well. I'm disappointed we lost, but I had a bit of hope for the future with that game. Anyway, enough of me. This is authors who've all appeared on this podcast: Murray, Sullivan, Dykes, Cuddy, who's not, and I'll speak to you later. Oh, and the author of the book from podcast 265, you'll be getting that with you shortly. Cheers.
There are some books available for you to buy, written by these three esteemed men beside me. I'm going to introduce shortly Stephen Murray's book, 10 Men Won the League, Paul Dykes' book, The Quality Street Gang, and Stephen Sullivan's book, the Sean Fallon biography. It's now available and it's out on paperback. A lot of you, I'm sure, have read the hardback, but Stephen tells me the paperback back's even better, so you can as well try it out. So that's the other, and the guys will obviously sign copies as well, so and probably the perfect Christmas present. I'm going to introduce these three men here in turn. Some of you might know them, but we'll throw them up to my media. It's Stephen Murray. Now Stephen wrote the book 10 Men Won the League, which is actually the story not just of that game in 1979, but of that whole 1978-79 season. I kind of got to know Stephen. Stephen's been doing some writing for the official Celtic match programme. Last season he did a series called My Greatest Game, and he chose, just in his opinion, what the best game of any particular former Celtic, what his best game in Celtic colours was. A fascinating read. We're always under pressure when we publish Stephen's work in the Celtic programme, not from Stephen but from his son, who pours over each week. First of all, checks to make sure that his dad's filing in the programme, otherwise there's hell to pay, and then if we've kind of let any mistakes slip in. But it's a really good series. This season he's doing one on debut day, so he's picking, you know, individual Celtics, and again just looking at their Celtic debut. Which can be good, bad or indifferent. For example, this Saturday he's focusing on Jimmy Johnson's debut, which didn't end up too great. It was a 6-0 defeat against Kilmarnock at Rugby Park, but obviously he went on to do great things. In the middle here is Paul John Dykes, who has already written one Celtic book and is on the verge of publishing another one. The first book I mentioned at the start was The Quality Street Gang, which again is, I think, for everybody, was always a very familiar phrase to anybody growing up as a Celtic fan. But it's Paul who has really gone into incredible depth and detail on that group, not just the players that maybe we all knew and loved, who went on to do great things for Celtic, but that whole collection of players that maybe for whatever reason it didn't quite work out for them. So a really fascinating read. And on December the 1st, Paul's new book is coming out, and again, I think, for every Celtic fan, I think it's a book that we're all looking forward to. It's the official biography of Mealy Mochan. Again, an incredible figure in our history, and Paul has written the biography of that, and I think that is a book that I think we're all looking forward to reading. And on the far right, Stephen Sullivan, who, as I said, has written Sean Fallon, the official biography of Sean Fallon. Stephen and I used to work together in the Celtic View. I'm the editor of the Celtic View, and Stephen and I used to work together, and Stephen worked at the Celtic View, and I have to say he was probably the most infuriating person that I ever worked with, because we'd be right on deadline. The deadline was always a Monday night, and we'd be honestly, we'd be literally on deadline. The printers would be phoning saying we need this copy, and Stephen would be going over it one last time. But the only thing I can have to say is that when Stephen gave you a copy, it was perfect. You just, there wasn't anything you needed to do with it. And I think we knew then at the Celtic View what a talented writer that Stephen was and Stephen is. And I think for any of us who read Sean Fallon's book, I think that was just further confirmation, that absolutely stunning read. And when I was thinking about what to say to introduce these guys, I'm thinking, what am I doing here? Because these guys have got an area of expertise, and we said it was going to be the kind of post-Lisbon to 1979 era. And I could only think that it was maybe because at some point over the last year I was kind of growing a beard that seemed to be some sort of tribute to Danny McGrain. Now, you may laugh at this, but when we went up to Dingwall a couple of weeks ago and we parked the car and we were heading into the ground, and a Celtic fan passed me and actually said, Danny McGrain, and insisted on getting his picture taken with him, which was a particular highlight for me. I just hope they had some friends who pointed out that in fact it wasn't Danny McGrain. What we're going to do is we're going to try and do 2 45-minute halves here, kind of trying to put in a football feel. The first half we'll kind of have a general discussion, and again, it is that kind of era post 1967 right up to 1979. Then we'll have a break, and in the second half we'll kind of just open it out and, you know, for questions from the floor, any questions about the specific books, era, or anything else you want to ask, the guys and myself will do our best to answer them. And I say, my first question, and kind of along the panel, what struck me, and I've said to the two Stevens and Paul individually, is that when you think of the books that they've written, Stephen's book on 10 men winning the league, Paul's two books, one on the Quality Street Gang and on Mealy Mochan, and of course Stephen's book on Sean Fallon, is these are some of the most important people and some of the most important events in Celtic history. It's only when they've published the books, I know for a fact, I'm thinking, why on earth has no one ever written about these guys or these events before? And that would be my first question, I think. And turn first to Stephen, then to Paul and Stephen, is why do you think that nobody had, before you had tackled that particular subject, that era, and those players and those men of that time?
Well, as far as I'm concerned with my own book, to fill you in the entire story, about 4 years ago it was John Doyle's 30th anniversary of his death. I took my son through to Kilmarnock, and Paul, that was there with Tony Hamilton and the Celtic guys, and it was an official commemoration of John's death. And it was ironic because Celtic were playing at Kilmarnock that day, and that was the game that most of us will recall. We were 3-0 down at half time, and we go right back to 3. So it was a real a day that will stick in memory for a long while. But I had the idea of the 4-2 game, doing a book for it, and I bumped into Tom Campbell. Now everybody here thinks he's heard of Tom Campbell. He's a wonderful guy, and he's wrote excuse me, he's wrote some wonderful Celtic books through the years. And I bumped into Tom, and I said, hey, Tom, have you any projects? And he goes, aye, I'm going to do a book about the 4-2 game. And that was my ship sunk. At that point, I can't compete with Tom Campbell. There's no point in even trying. And I actually got his email address, because I was going to help him in some small way with his project about the 4-2 game. And I think Tom, I'm thinking like the same Tom goes between Scotland and Canada. And he went back to Canada, and he sent me an email saying that he put it in the back burner and he was going to do something else. And at that point I thought, well, you know what, if he's not going to do it, then somebody should do it. And at that point I stepped into the breach. So it was a sort of like a fait accompli, if you like, you know, it just sort of fell into place. And then after that, I was really pleased with the you know, like you contact people on websites and things and word of mouth, and people seemed really enthusiastic and they seemed really keen that, this was going to, this project was going to take place. But I think the most heartwarming thing for me was I managed to speak to maybe like 7 or 8 of the team that played that night, and every one of them was really, really enthusiastic about doing this, because they each said, I think only Danny McGrain would say that it was in the highlight of his career, because that Danny had such a career, he won cups, God knows what else. But every other guy in the team said, oh, you know, we knew that night that we need to win the European Cup to beat that feeling. You know, it was such a momentous night and a great night in Celtic's history that a few of them actually said that even as young men, they were saying, how do we beat this? How are we going to, you know, how can we go past this? So they did try their best. They won a few trophies and all the odd magic moments, but you know, every one of them said that that night at Celtic Park, beating Rangers 4-2, it was a highlight of their professional lives.
I think with the Quality Street Gang, it was quite a geographical thing, I mean, because my mother was from High Valleyfield. I don't know if anybody in the room has visited High Valleyfield. I was brought up in High Valleyfield and I played football there. And the two guys that used to be on the team, Mick Hutton and Ian Downey, whose son scored in the World Cup final in 1989 for under-16s, were big pals of George, so they drummed it into us from 10 years of age. Got this hero called George Connolly, who somehow came out of High Valleyfield and possessed this phenomenal talent. So I'd heard stories of Connolly. I was a wee bit obsessed with him, actually. And at Christmas time, my birthday's in December, so I would always get the Celtic books of that period. And the first thing I would do is go to the index and find the pages on George Connolly and read about him. He was my hero. My mother kind of fed that obsession by buying the old Topical Times books at car boot sales and Oxfams, and it was always Connolly, and there was, you know, as I say, a wee bit of a mystique about this guy, about the Keepy Uppy King. So that's where my interest in initially George Connolly was born, and from that I learnt about the Quality Street Gang. I remember getting the centenary video, it would have been, and David Hay was interviewed in it, and he mentioned the Quality Street Gang. And from that day, 1988 or 89, right up to writing the book, I had no idea where that name came from. So that was something that I was interested to try and find out. Unfortunately, I published the book, still never found out after the book came out. So if there's ever a paperback, I may explain in full what it is. But George Connolly was my obsession, Paul, and unfortunately, he was before my time. Everybody I spoke to who played with him, or seen him playing, basically described it as a joy, and it was quite tragic really that George didn't play a lot longer than he did. Why other writers didn't write about the Quality Street Gang always kind of puzzled me. Thought it was a really good subject, and so I decided to do it myself. And a strange story occurred. There's a famous picture on the back of the book, actually, and it was taken in 68 in Casale Monferrato in Italy. Dalglish isn't in the picture because he was a sub, couldn't get a game, that's how good this team were. And I remember looking at that image, and I always pride myself on my kind of Celtic knowledge, and there was two guys I couldn't name in the team. So after I met George, he named them for me, and one of them was called John Murray, who played with Celtic, never played in the first team. So I tracked him down for an interview, and it was through that interview that John introduced me to Paul and Celtic Football Club. So it was a complete, you know, twisty fate that Celtic eventually published the book. It was through meeting John. I wanted to speak to him about his football career. He says, well, that'll take 5 minutes, but I've got a wee proposition for you, and he introduced me to the Celtic guys. And again, once I got in a room with some of the people working in the View, etc., then you realise that your Celtic knowledge isn't as good as you thought it was. So it was a fantastic experience for me, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I mean, for me, obviously working at The View, spoken to Sean Farr a good number of times, and it always tend to be maybe around the anniversary of like a big game, 7-1, or about Jock Stein or something, and you always felt when you spoke to me, you were just scratching the surface. You know, you were maybe even 1,500 words, and you thought, there's so much more this guy could go into. And I always wondered at the time, never thinking myself I would do it, why is this guy not done a book? And years went by, I left The View, And then it was Martin Neil from Backpage Press had approached me about something, about another idea. And I said, if you're looking to do a Celtic book, I said, for me, the story, the guy who was there from the 50s, you know, through the, had the ultimate perspective, and Jock Stein was there when things kind of started to go downhill. I said, with Sean Fallon, you know, and contributed so much. But I said, I can't believe he's not been approached over the years. You know, I said, I can't believe he's not wanted to do, you know, he's not been asked to do something. So I got in touch with the family. Sure enough, he'd been approached many times, and he said, you're just too late. He said, we'd love to do something with you. He's actually, your time's a few days out. Said Sir Alex Ferguson, earlier in the year, finally convinced him when he was coming up. He was 89, going on 90. Finally convinced him that his story was too good. You know, he had to tell it. And he said, but we just agreed to do it with someone else. And so I was pretty gutted. And then, sure enough, that similar situation to Tom Campbell. That fell through. And I was just in the right place. It went up and met Sean, and it's what you admire. And the great thing about Sean Fallon was when you meet him, he was just a lovely man. That was the case. I knew that from the view. And he seemed to be quite happy. And from then, it just kind of went from there. He was terrific. He just he spoke so well. You know, a guy that was pushing 90. And it was terrific. It was a great time because it was around the time, you know, Flag Day, he was appearing. And so all these things were coming back to him anyway. And so I was just in the right place, almost in the wrong place, but just in the right place at the right time. And it was so good to get him. I think his family are very happy that he did something, because he'd resisted for so many years. I think he was such a humble man, he'd always seen it as a bit of an indulgence, and maybe that to do a book, maybe you had to go down the route of, I think he'd maybe been hurt by one or two other books that had been written, and I think he maybe thought, I don't want to hurt people. And I think he took a bit of convincing, but it was so... Thanks to Alex Ferguson, to thank the guys at Backpage, and then thank mostly Sean and Myra for kind of going ahead with it. But he was absolutely fantastic, and I'm so glad that he did it before he sadly passed away, because I think he had such a great story, and something, you know, I think the wiki said was a piece of the jigsaw that needed to be added, and I really do feel that, whether it was myself or someone else that did it, Sean had a story that needed to be told.
Advertising this event, and we kind of decided on that year of 1967 after we won the European Cup up to 10 men won the league in 1979. Paul, maybe I ask you first, was part of the reason why these subjects that you guys have written about, they weren't touched before, is it because they were almost living in the immediate shadow of Lisbon, that was just so extraordinary an achievement that everything else, regardless of how good it was, almost pales not in significance, but pales in comparison?
I think that's a massive reason, a massive factor, but certainly the Quality Street Gang haven't been written about. And I mean, when you look at the achievements of Lisbon, you can totally understand that. I was kind of looking from a different angle, because I quickly realised there was quite a few players in the Quality Street Gang team who, and I said that to you before, Paul, you know, in any other era they'd have been regulars in the Celtic side. But because the squad we had was so strong, many of them had to move on. I mean, some of them say John Gorman was a phenomenal left back, and up to a certain point was on a level with Danny McGrain. And you just think to yourself, how could anybody be on a level with Danny McGrain? But you know, the development went up to maybe 18, 19, and half a dozen of them, just the ride was meteoric. But unfortunately, some of the other guys fell by the wayside and didn't achieve as much, certainly in Celtic jerseys. So yeah, I think that shadow probably was a reason that people didn't really establish the Quality Street Gang as a famous group in the club's history. But again, I found that it was a part of the interesting story, is why some of them didn't make it, you know. And some of the tales were really quite sad. I've mentioned George, and Big George's tale was probably the saddest of them all, because the guy's ability was incredible. I mean, I'm obviously still in touch with my family for High Valleyfield, so I go in now and again, and we still talk about him. You know, this genius footballer that used to do keep uppies around High Valleyfield wearing Wellington boots in the rain. You know, the guy was a genius even from a young age, and everybody knew what he had, but the only thing he didn't have was the mentality to see it through. You know?
Steve Sullivan, for Sean's story, kind of feels like every post-war event that Celtic celebrated, extraordinary, obviously 7-1, for example, has been Sean was part of. And I suppose did he, obviously the club is striving after 67 just to try and get back there and get back there?
Yeah, I mean the funny thing is talking about Lisbon and the way, you know, you kind of moving on from that. I mean, I've just been with the good fortune of reading Paul's Neely Malkin book as well, and in both the Sean book and the Neely book, Lisbon hasn't gone into in great detail, almost because I think it's been covered in such great detail. You know, get the esteemed Celtic author and historian Pat Woods in tonight, and guys like him have covered it, so you could go back over fantastic stories from Lisbon, you know, very old singing in the tunnel, these kind of stories that everyone loves, but they've been done. And so I think in the show that Lisbon gets less than a chapter, it just seems ridiculous in a way. But you just think, well, unless you've got something fresh, so with us it was Sean getting Billy up to the trophy, or, you know, getting the bench of Ferreira. But I think with we wanted to do something, you know, don't just kind of go over the same stories, it's the same with the guys' books. And that's what as well what I enjoyed about the College Street guy and the other books as well, was I picked up thinking, is this going to be about Ken Dalglish and Dan McGrain and the guys you know about? And it's the stories you don't know about, and that's what I liked. I thought, let's not go over the same things you've maybe read from Sean in a newspaper article or whatever. You know, let's have something a little bit fresh. And I think that's what people have enjoyed about the various books, is that, you know, there are different stories in there. And if, you know, Lisbon's obviously, you know, it couldn't be. Sean did say he enjoyed 7-1 more than Lisbon, he said, because he said you couldn't beat. He said he enjoyed him throwing Rangers down. But he said he enjoyed 7-1 slightly more than Lisbon, believe it or not. But he said he appreciated that Lisbon was of greater significance. But he said that you can't, you know, in terms of nothing beat playing. He said, you know, in terms of going out there and achieving something yourself. And I think he appreciated, because he was coming to the end of his career. He was older than people realised, of course, but he was coming to the end of his career, realised he wouldn't have many more days like that. And of course, there aren't many days like that. But yeah, I think Lisbon, as I say, it might seem really strange that it's covered in such little detail in both books, but I think it makes sense not to go over something that's been covered so well, you know, time and time again. So it was only to try and add anything fresh that we could, and hopefully that was done.
I suppose with Steve, with the season that 10 men won the league, it was Billy's first season as manager, obviously important for him to put down a marker as, you know, having gone from player, left the club and then come back as the boss.
Absolutely. I don't think, considering the season that we had before it in 77-78, I don't think anybody the best we could have hoped for really was a place in Europe. And right up to the very end of the season, Billy McNeil, in his statements to the press, had said that he never ever mentioned winning the league until the last three or four games, when it became obvious that it was a two-horse race between us and Rangers. The curious thing about that season was Dundee United blew it. They were in front from January right through to about late April. And they had three games left at the end of the season. They played Rangers at Tannadice, they get beat 2-1. They played us at Parkhead, they get beat 2-1. And then they drew with Aberdeen. Now, if they'd won maybe two or three games, then there's a good chance that they could have won it. And people often fail to appreciate that was the beginning of that great Dundee United team, just coming to the fore. So it was, you know, some of the players that played that night as well, I remember discussing it with a friend, and I said, guys like Andy Lynch and Shuggie Edwardson and Johnny Doyle, God rest his soul, they'll never be remembered as Celtic greats. But what they each had is something that I believe that great Celtic players have, and that's heart. And it really kills me now to see that some of the modern players who have got the technical ability, but they don't have that heart in them, don't have that desire, they don't have that wee sort of X factor that makes, in my opinion, a Celtic player a really good Celtic player. And these guys that night stood up to be counted, especially when Doyle got sent off, and people talk about formations these days. David Proven says at the very end we were playing something like, there was no midfield, there was like two guys at the back and seven guys up front running out like a goal. He says that the whole shape of the team went to blazes. He said it was like a schoolboy game. It was like something you would see in the old 50 pitches in the old days of Glasgow Greeners or something like that. He says that everything at the Dundee, it was just sheer passion that got them over the line. And the whole thing about that season, that if I had to recall it and sum it up in one thing, is passion. Because if it hadn't been for those guys playing for Celtic, playing for that jersey, then they wouldn't have gave as much as they did give. And certainly they wouldn't have won that championship.
actually ahead of the Q&A, I should really warn you, if anybody follows Stephen on Twitter, and he obviously does have a certain level of nostalgia, don't ask him about the difference between two up front and one up front, because it'll be like a form of human combustion. It's a touchy subject for him. Stephen mentioned the season before, 10 men won the league. It wasn't a great season. I was going to ask Stephen Sullivan. One of the things I think in your book in particular is the season where, you know, Sean was in charge and it didn't quite work out for us. And I think that gave a real perspective and a proper perspective on what actually happened that season, which I think was really important to do.
I mean, I was really interested in that. I really wanted to go into that and the early 60s and find out, you know, because it's sometimes seen as a bit of blot in Sean's copybook. He's seen as a Celtic legend. You know, he signed all these players and did all these fantastic things and was great for Steam, but the early 60s and 75, 76 are seen as kind of blots in his copybook. And I mean, he held his hands up, you know, especially the early 60s. 75, 76, I didn't appreciate until I went back over it how difficult it was for him and how many obstacles were in his path, really, you know, in terms of losing. Well, Billy McNeil had retired the season just before. Jimmy Johnson had been moved on, you know, Brogan left. You know, because of Jockstein's accident, really hadn't had the chance to replace these guys. You know, Eddie Valson came in quite late. Johnny Doyle came in late in the season, was injured 20 minutes into his debut. You know, so it was he couldn't have really had any worse luck. And even then, they actually did better than the season before. They completely collapsed in the season before to lose the 10 in a row that were going for, and then they completely collapsed and they recovered well. And the feeling Bobby Lennox and all these guys said Sean was doing a good job, you know, he was in the coverage in the press that I was looking back on was really favourable. The problem was that they kept on losing to Rangers, and that was a kind of psychological thing. And Rangers came on strong second half of the season, and yeah, just but he had such a tough time. And then what I didn't realise as well, when Sean was quite open about, was that he was always so low to be critical of Jock's team, but he said he understood that Jock would want to come back in and have a say once Jock was fit again. He said, but as it was, for whatever reason, he didn't want to come back in total charge. He said he was not quite undermined, but it was a little bit like the situation where Jimmy McGrory was in charge, but there was someone behind pulling the strings, in that case, Bob Kelly. He said, in this case, it was Jock's team, and he said, I just felt I wish he'd just come back. You know, if he was going to come back, just come back as manager. Don't leave me in charge and kind of in notional charge. And he said, the players, he could read that, and speaking to the players, he said they kind of weren't too sure, because he said like Jock's team would be sitting in the corner of the dressing room. He said Sean would be doing the team talk, but you weren't sure who's really. He said you knew that Jock's team wasn't the kind of character who would sit back and just kind of let things go by. So I think it was a really difficult season, really tough, and I think it's a real shame that for a lot of fans, and hopefully the book maybe changed that came to define Sean a little bit, and people to say, oh well, that surely really couldn't be a manager. Because I speaking to all the players and the guys around that time and the Fergusons and things, they said in the right circumstances at the right time that Sean Fallon could have been a manager. Not a manager, and Sean was open that it's not a manager of the same calibre as Jockstein, but a successful manager all the same. And the way that seems is that because of 75, 76 and because of the way it's almost seen unfairly again that he was in charge in the early 60s, that he wasn't up to, which is really, I think, unfair. And hopefully, again, that the book gives a kind of clearer picture on that.
Because one of the things I think when you look back in that era, it's obviously with the level of hindsight, but what happened after Lisbon, did the team break up too quickly? Was that, what reason was that for? You know, did the following season when we got knocked out in the first round, did that help precipitate it? Paul, was it the fact that Jockstein and obviously Sean Fallon, they knew that there was this group of extraordinarily talented young players coming through, that pushed them on, and maybe some of the older guys, the experienced guys, maybe left before they should have, and maybe the blend should have been kept for longer?
I think so. I think one of the players who, that certainly was his opinion, was Bobby Lennox, who I spoke to recently. And he says, you know, looking back now, it's easy to say what should have been done differently. But if they kept a wee bit more of the experience, and I think the player that every single ex-player I spoke to who was pointed out as leaving too soon was Bobby Murdoch. And if they just kept these players with their experience, it might have helped to nurture some of the other quality sheet kids who didn't quite come through the way that we had hoped So that's certainly the from the players' angle, from Bobby Lennox, and I think John Hughes, when I spoke to John, Willie Wallace, they felt that, you know, the Lisbon Lions might not have been playing every week, but just to have them at Barrowfield to help some of the younger guys to come through. But it must have been a very, very difficult situation for even Joxton, you know, to have this group of, you know, unique talents coming through and have the greatest side that Scotland's ever produced as your first team. What do you do, you know? And he didn't do too bad. But I think the Quality Street gang, for me, Paul Wilson spoke about it, could have done even more, you know. You had a couple of the guys going down to England, three of them eventually. George was lost in the season. You were speaking about Stephen, Brian McLaughlin obviously had suffered an injury, but then his mental attitude wasn't right in Sean's season in charge, and he went missing, etc. So, and there was another guy who was mentioned affectionately, John McCluskey, who came in a wee bit later. So, you know, when you're looking at bad luck, for anybody to lose this calibre of player, three of them, in a short space of time, and then lose David Haley, McCarry, and eventually Kenny Dalglish, I mean, that's an incredible amount of talent to be losing in a very, very short space of time. And that probably led us on to the era that Stephen then spoke about. You know, the team that Billy McNeil inherited was a shadow of any of Jock Stephen's previous sides.
One of the things, obviously, there's fine lines between success and failure, and after Lisbon, we reached one final. It's a point we lost. We reached two semi-finals. We lost one in penalties, and the other one we were disgracefully kicked off the park. So there's a fine line between success and failure. Stephen, I know you're working on another project that's kind of focused on Kenny Dalglish, and he was obviously gone by the time that the 10 men won the league. But, you know, how important was he in that period? And is what he subsequently did at Liverpool, has that overshadowed what he did for Celtic during those years?
I certainly think so. One of the most irritating things about when you buy a book about Kenny Dalglish is there's two chapters about Celtic and 10 chapters about Liverpool. There's no doubt he was successful at Liverpool, and, you know, the playing in that great Liverpool team, that's a tremendous source of pride. But as Paul was touched on there, he played in two European Cup semi-finals with Celtic, and he was with us in the first team for like 8 seasons. So that story, I think, is getting flies to be put in the bones, which is a project that I'm working on at the moment. And I think people, especially younger boys, will say, Kenny Dalglish, did he really play for Celtic? You know, even my son will tell me, he knows he was Liverpool manager, he knows he's on the TV, then he's pundit. And when I tell him that he was my hero, one of my heroes when I was a boy, and he was actually a successful Celtic captain, you know, like, younger kids are a wee bit sort of perplexed, they don't always realise that. So Paul's right there, that the least leaving, I think, in my opinion, is the single worst thing that ever happened to me as a Celtic fan. You talk about Black Sunday and all these games, but we win games, we lose games. There's never been a game, I think, that we've really suffered from. We lost those semi-finals and it was painful. We lose the cup finals and it's painful, but that feeling of the least walking as a schoolboy is something that will live with me forever. It was a horrible feeling. And people are saying that he had to go and they get the offer and all the rest of this stuff. And you know, I wonder if it's something to be scratched under the surface. John Fallon's brought a book out recently about the ex-Celtic goalkeeper. And there's a line in it, and I'd love to speak to him to enhance what he said. And he said, the story is still to be told about why Dalglish left. So that's something that's news to me. Because, you know, you always get the rhetoric that somehow that everybody knew it was his time, and, you know, he couldn't stand in his way kind of thing. So I don't know what John's talking about, but it'd be interesting to maybe see if he's sitting something. Also, Stephen had something in his book that absolutely amazed me, was that on the day that Kenny Dalglish signed for Liverpool, maybe even the day after, he turned up at Sean's door. I think you'd better tell this story for this point.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think they'd always had a good relationship. Obviously, Sean was the one that went up to his house and spotted him initially. They'd always, when Sean made him captain the season he was in charge, they'd always go on well, and Sean felt that he had a good, you know, he knew what would keep Kenny. He always felt to the end Kenny would have stayed. And he said the day after they'd gone to Liverpool, which was, he felt was a devastating moment as well, Sean, he, Myra was saying he came home and he just had his head in his hands. He said they don't know what they've done. And Kenny came out to Sean and Myra's house and he was breaking his heart, you know, and the kids drowned, and he was, yeah, they said he was really, really, really sad about it. Maybe it was just the emotion of it. I mean, you know, you read Kenny's own books and he's quite adamant he wanted to go, and he wanted to go for a little while, and he was on the verge of going, obviously, in 75, and Sean had convinced him to stay. But certainly Sean was completely adamant. He said he just needed to feel that he was loved and he was wanted, you know, in terms of maybe giving him, not that he was a greedy player, but maybe, you know, just showing him that he was held in the kind of esteem that he wanted to be held, and maybe that Liverpool were showing him, and showing him also that Celtic had ambition, and maybe in both respects that didn't happen. But yeah, I was surprised as well, having read Kenny's books, and to you know, him making it was quite a cold decision to then hear he was drowned at Sean's. And I mean, Myra said he was bawling, you know, really breaking his heart. So yeah, it was quite an interesting time. I mean, the thing I found amazing about the leash coming through, and you talk about semi-finals and things, and the quality street game, was, I think there's a view of Celtic's history that it kind of peaked in Lisbon, and then it was always a slight downhill from then on. And I just find it amazing that it really didn't have to be that way, you know, because of the quality street gang coming through, because of the fact that the Lisbon team was young, you know, it was a young average age, that it really could have been a team that went on for a long time if it had been managed right and right kind of luck. It always had a fantastic manager, and I think it was a real waste that didn't happen. And whether it was the final game that convinced Jockstein really that was the time to move on the lines and to completely go with the quality street gang almost en masse, I don't know. But you just feel, you look at the squad pictures from say 68, 69, and it's just frightening. I mean, the squads were so much stronger than they were 66, 67. You know, the squad is just frightening. You think about a Danny McGrain coming into a team with the Lions in the late 20s, you know, Doug Leash making his way through, McGarry, you know, these guys, George Connolly, of course. You know, the potential, I really think Celtic could have been another Ajax or a Bayern Munich. Maybe it's wishful thinking, but I really think that obviously they weren't far away in 70, they weren't far away in the semi-finals. I think if you look at the sheer talent and the fact they had a brilliant manager, there's no reason why in the late 60s and early 70s Celtic couldn't have, you know, won another European Cup or two.
It's interesting you mentioned the 70 European Cup final. Maybe that made up Jockstein's mind, because if you speak to some of the players that played there, they just felt it was maybe one of the few times where he maybe just underestimated the opposition, but on a one-off, and they all felt if they got a replay would have won the game, because they then knew how fine it would have played. But you know, we were touching on, you know, when Kenny left in 77, but he wasn't the first Paul of the quality street gang to go, and was that a kind of sign of the way football was going, that some of those players who in a previous generation would have stayed as a one club men once one or two of them started to go to England, that kind of encouraged others to go?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at Lisbon, the actual loyalty to each and every one of those players was phenomenal, the length of time each of them stayed at Celtic Park. But, you know, I think it was almost like a return to maybe what Celtic were doing in the 50s, and having looked at that a wee bit more with Neely's book, you know, selling the top players like Bobby Collins and Willie Fermi to the English clubs. And, of course, there's always this talk of the Celtic youngsters getting into the Scotland team, and they're maybe speaking to English-based players, and they're having a look at the comparison between the wages. So obviously money came into it as well. And I think when you look at McCarrie leaving, Celtic had a number of fantastic strikers at that time. And, you know, Hay, Connolly and Dalglish were massive losses, as was McCarrie. But at that time, you could almost understand why Celtic would sell him, because of the squad that we had going back to what you said, Stephen. The saddest thing is, when you actually start speaking to the players, you do find out a wee bit more, and Davy Hay obviously had his strike with Celtic, and which seems bizarre to go on strike when Jockstein's the manager. You know, he must have been a brave man. But after that, and after a fantastic World Cup, Davy had decided he was going to buy a pub to make the extra money up, and he was going to stay at Celtic. And he was told he wasn't staying at Celtic. So there was obviously a lot of things happening that fans weren't aware of. You know, David Hay decided he wanted to stay, but he was told that he was going, and obviously went for another record transfer fee. So that was a massive thing. I mean, you look at the youth policy we had at that time, and the money that was being made, the money that was being made selling, you know, talented players. And I think a few of the players actually says to me as well, that might have saved George, but I disagree with that. I don't think anything would have changed, even if he went to the NASL or you know, down south. Nothing would have changed what happened to George.
I just want to committed and enhance what Paul was saying, there. In the process of doing a wee bit of research for the Kenny Rogues thing, I was very fortunate to speak to Archie McPherson. Now, for a wee guy like me that all through the 1970s, he watched Archie in the sports scene. That was a dream come true. He's such a nice guy and he's such a knowledgeable guy that it was an absolute pleasure to be in his company. But there's one thing he said and it sprung to mind when Paul was talking to David here. Archie says that he was in the 74 World Cup and Jock Steen was with Archie to do the bit that they're in the gantry together, you know, they didn't have quite have what you have now with your big panels. The Jock Steen was there to summarise when Archie was doing the commentating. So Archie says, for the whole time we were there in the World Cup, he says, Jock Steen and I were inseparable because we were professionally together and we also hung about together and had meals and obviously Jock's not a drinker and all that, but Jock Steen held court virtually every night, and he says you've got all these English guys that would come because England weren't there in the 74 World Cup, so they had to fill a wee bit of space, and they were hanging in Jock's every word, and Jock Steen absolutely bummed Kenny Dalglish up to the highest hill, and he told anybody that would listen what a player is. He's going to take the World Cup to storm. He's the best player in Scotland, he's going to be the best player in Britain, he's the man, he's the guy, he's the best player we've got, he's the best player Scotland have got. And Archie McPherson remembers thinking, I don't know if he's trying to punt him here. Seriously. And he said, I'm not being funny. I know a couple of guys are laughing right, but it sounds like it. But Archie McPherson says, I genuinely felt, he says, he's trying to sell him. He says, but what happened is Kenny had a poor tournament. But his own standards, he didn't play very well in either of the three games. In fact, he got substituted in every one of the games. But the guy who really had the World Cup in the Scotland team was Davy Hay. The Davy Hay went head to head with Rivellino and played him off the park. And you know, like Scotland should have beat Brazil that night. It was phenomenal to see. And Archie says, I remember getting back, and within a couple of weeks, it was in the paper, out of the blue, and I think Paul was saying that Davy didn't want to go, and there wasn't really any talk about it. Davy had settled his troubles with Celtic at that time. And Archie says, I remember buying a morning paper that says, Davy Hay goes to Chelsea for a Scottish record fee, 200,000, and he says, to this day, nobody will ever convince me that Jock's trying to sell somebody. And he couldn't sell the leash in the back of the World Cup, so he sold Davy Hay.
Is one of the Stephen, again, back to your book, when you're talking about players leaving, and again, one of the kind of almost crucial relationships that Sean and Jock had was with Bob Kelly, and that idea that when he, between the three of them, they kind of almost worked out how it was going to work for Celtic, and it was when Bob Kelly died that the whole dynamic within the club changed.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I know Bob Kelly's a divisive figure, to say the least, and it was by no means you know, entirely everything he did for Celtic was fantastic, but during that period when Jock Steen came back as manager until he died, he said he was, you know, Sean was adamant that he was, and not just Sean actually, but George Steen, Jock's son, who I spoke to for the book, he said that Bob Kelly was brilliant with him, you know, he was absolutely, you know, a perfect chairman at that point, you know, that they, and they involved him. I think they were clever, and obviously Jock Steen was a clever, he knew to keep him, they always had little meetings after games, and they would chat and make him feel involved, make it clear that the line was drawn, you know, in terms of he couldn't interfere in team selection after a few little early instances. But the one thing, if you notice that, and Paul touched on it there, is it really, you know, you look at the recent Celtic history and selling players down south, the things that, you know, Kenny Dalglish and Davy Hay and all that is the norm in Celtic's history, really. You know, it was the period between 65 and Bob Kelly dying that was, they didn't sell any of the big players, you know, and they held on to the guys that had won European Cup and were, you know, being sought after down south and throughout Europe, and Boca Juniors, I think, were, you know, like, so that, I think, is where maybe he doesn't get the credit he probably sometimes deserves. Sean was certainly very much of the view of that, and I know that George Steen felt that once Bob Kelly died and Desmond White came in, the relationship, you know, the chemistry at the club was never the same. The way the club was run was completely different, just in terms of money being, you know, the be all and end all. When he said when Bob Kelly was there, it really was, whatever you say about Bob Kelly, that Celtic was what he wanted to do. Just, that was at the heart of everything he did. Not everything he did was right, but they said that Celtic was genuine at the heart. And don't get me wrong, Bob Kelly sold key players. He sold, you know, the Bobby Collinses and the Fernies and these kind of guys. Paddy Creran's obviously for different reasons, early 60s. But during that period, it was the, I don't know, maybe Pat might tell me another period in Celtic's history where we kept our best players, maybe when they were more sought after than any period in our history. And for that, you know, what, 7 years, 7, 8, 9 years, we kept our best players. And obviously McCarrie was the first to go, I think, the first big man to go. But as Paul said, he was kind of dispensable because you had great strikers at the time at the club that were coming through, great strikers already there. David Hay, it seemed to me, was the first one you thought, you know, he's really going to leave a hole. And if you read Danny McGrain's, I find Danny McGrain's book really fascinating in the late 70s. He made a big point about David Hay. He said it was really, that was a key moment in Celtic, maybe just slipping away from the stands, as he said, in the late 60s and early 70s, because he said he was almost like the heartbeat of the team. And that's been that, and Danny didn't hold back in that book at all, you know, in terms of his own teammates and everything. But yeah, I think that was the key. That was when they started losing players that they really didn't want to lose and they couldn't afford to lose. And then from then on, and Kenny Dalglish was the, I suppose, the big symbol that really Celtic had given up. I mean, they'd given up trying to be, you know, a European Cup winner anymore, because as soon as you lose, they can kind of symbol the captain and everything, then it was kind of clear to everyone that the glory days were over. And that's maybe why it had such an effect on the psyche of all the supporters and everything, because, yeah, he was the big symbol of the club at the time.
Excuse me. It's funny Stephen was saying about Danny McGrain's book. Danny wrote two books, and I was really privileged to interview Danny for when I was doing my book. He was a captain that night before two game, and I said, have you ever thought about writing another book, Danny? And he said, nah son, he said, I've already done two. I said, you should really think about doing another one, because you know you're at an age now, you're looking back, and sometimes as you get to a certain age in life, you think back and things come back that you might not have thought about when you were younger. And he says, do you remember the book? He says that the one that Stephen's talking about. He said it's a green cover. He says, and there's a photo on it. He says it's my head and shoulders, chest upwards. He says I didn't like that photograph. And I said, funny thing, Danny. I said they brought a Rangers man out at the same time. It was Derek Johnson with the same photo. He said must have been some size of books. On, he says, I'm in the front. He says they're going to get it on a shelf.
The funny thing about Danny, just to dwell on that, was we did an interview with him and we recorded, and I've got to say, in terms of doing it, I mean, he's got the worst memory, and this is not an uncommon thing for footballers. His memory's terrible. I mean, like, just in terms of remembering any games or anything. But I was talking to him about that book, and I was saying, if that book was out today, it'd be back pages for weeks, you know, in terms of, and it'd be front pages, you know, because he really stuck into the guys who he was in a dressing room with. But he was hard. I didn't remember that being a big deal, you know, and just obviously how the times change. There was no fuss about it at the time, and but yeah, I could believe that, because as I say, Danny, he's such a good guy. And he's not a guy that comes out, as you know, and makes a big fuss about things. But I think when he speaks his mind, that's for sure, you know. And I think in that book, he certainly did.
Paul, you obviously, Danny was one of the players you interviewed for your book, and I always remember the launch night you had at Celtic Park, and quite a lot of the Quality Street gang came along that night, and it was actually wonderful to see, and I think for them all to get back together again and kind of feel that they were appreciated. But I think your book maybe surprised people just how wide that talent pool was, and the lens you went to speak to everybody was there. Was there a particular highlight in terms of the people that you met and interviewed and got to know?
Absolutely. I mean, for any Celtic fan speaking to the players of that era, every interview was a thrill for me. But strangely enough, I've spoken to you about this, Stephen, as well, but the Sean Farrell interview was mind-blowing for me at that time. And it came as a complete surprise to me, because of his age, I didn't make any effort to actually track Sean down. But believe it or not, I was trying to get an interview with Chris Shevlin, because he had signed just after the European Cup win, and he says, all right, no problem, I'll meet you at such and such a time in the Great Western Road. Do you want me to bring Sean along? And I thought, well, Sean who? And it's Sean Fallon, because obviously Shevlin's son married Sean's daughter. And so I sat for 3 hours in the blazing sun talking about Celtic with Sean Fallon. And, you know, so... And he had that wicked sense of humour. You will have seen this yourself, Stephen. And just wee things like a young girl would walk past him in the street and he would just shout over to her, "Are we still on for Wednesday night?" and you've done it in such a charming way that, you know, I no problem, I'll see you at such and such a time, you know. But one thing that stuck in my mind, this chap walked past and he had the hoops on. And he'd done a double take at Sean, obviously, and Ketty. He almost walked into a lamppost and he walked on. And Sean says, "Can you imagine doing that?" And I said, "What's this? Wearing a Celtic strip?" But he was serious. He says, "He's a grown man, he's walking about the street with a Celtic top on." And that was Sean's attitude. But I know what he was trying to say, you know, that obviously the sign of the times, etc. But that's what he said. And obviously, in his day, you couldn't buy a Celtic replica jersey. But that was my biggest thrill. And obviously, going back to Danny McGain, meeting Danny at Lennox Town was phenomenal. And he had a good sense of humour as well. But George, for me, was just, you know, that was fantastic. Because, again, I had my father worked with George's brother, and, you know, my aunt was at his christening and things like that. And he was a mystical figure, and he disappeared for so long. So I got in touch with George through his son, and we met in the Unicorn in Kincardine, and we were both on the diet Iron Blues, and he was great company and just a really, really nice guy. And the strange thing about George, he told me he had absolutely no regrets, you know, and everybody else has got them for him, but George himself says, you know, "I've done alright, 26-year-old, Scotland's played the European Cup final," and he was quite happy with that. But I think his contemporaries knew that he could have taken it even a stage further. And again, going back to David Hay, many, many people said, when we lost David, we lost George. So, yeah, it was a great experience. And for anybody thinking about doing it, even if you don't get published, go for it, because you meet some incredible people.
Yeah, I was going to say that as a Celtic fan, to be able to sit in the company of these guys and film to... But I think there's a level of humility there that sometimes surprises you because of the things that they did in their life. We're almost at the brain of the book, so I was just going to ask the three of you in turn, when you were doing the book, was there anything about that time that surprised you, that you found out that you thought your level of knowledge? I know, Stephen, you can tell me who took a throw in the 55th minute in a game against Hearts, and what was there anything that kind of surprised the three of you in turn when you were doing your book?
There was a couple of wee surprises. The first thing I got offended to me was Ronnie Gladden Sports opening up in flames. And it was actually quite a harrowing experience, because halfway through the trial, the procurator Fiscal decided that they had knowledge that he was going to abscond and run away, which was nonsense, because if he was going to run away, he would have run away before it. You wouldn't have run away halfway during the trial. So they put him in Barbunny for 2 nights. And you know, for a footballer to get into a prison and spend 2 nights in it, it must have been a dreadful experience. And afterwards, he got found not proven. And I spoke to a few of the players, and I said, "Well, Gladden must have been in a terrible state." They said, "Oh, why?" And I said, "Well, not proven." I said, "So that's, you know, he didn't need a date and all that." And he said, "What do you mean he didn't need a date?" He said, "His nickname was Bluebell. For Bluebell matches, which was the joke." that came as a surprise, because, you know, let's just say that I wasn't there at the time in court, and some of them were, because some of his teammates actually went to court to literally support him through his ordeal. So that was a surprise. But the big disappointment for me was Alfie Corn, when he spoke to me. And I understand why he wouldn't talk, because Alfie, for maybe three quarters of the season, was in the first team, scored quite a few goals, and one of the main men. And I couldn't understand when I started doing the book that in March the 3rd, they scored the winning goal against Aberdeen, which was a big, big game for us, getting back into the league title race. And by April the 7th, it was basically a free transfer out the door. So what went on between March the 3rd and April the 7th? And when I phoned him up, he was a nice guy, and he was perfectly pleasant. And he said, "The biggest disappointment in my career was the way I left Celtic." He says, "And I don't want to say anything," he says, "because I don't have any intention of getting into a debate with anybody after all these years." He says, all I would say is, he says, "I was devastated when I left, because I loved playing for Celtic." He says, "And guys like Johnny Doyle and Tom McAdam, they reined them off, but were good friends of his. He regarded them as personal friends." So I would love to have maybe get a wee bit more out of Alfie moving on, but the rest of the guys said that there was a training session, and Billy McNeil and Alfie had it up literally up on the Barfield. And when they get back into Celtic Park, the players went into the home dressing room to get showered, and Alfie got dragged into the away dressing room, and frankly, he was never seen again, because in their days, the club held all the aces. There was no freedom of contract then, so Alfie's contract got paid up and he got shown the door. So obviously there was a disagreement with Billy, and I wonder if maybe in later years Alfie regrets that. So that was something that maybe quite sad.
I think one of the big things, I was watching David Potter on your Celtic TV recently, and he said that, you know, the history has been covered extensively, but there is always something that people don't know. And often you get that in the interviews if you track down the players. And it was Kenny Dalglish had said to me that, you know, Graham Souness was up training with the Quality Street kids as a young laddie, and Celtic didn't sign him when he went down to Spurs. And that came as a surprise to me. I think he's since spoken about it, because I started writing that about 5 years ago. But Danny McGrain, surprisingly, couldn't remember it. But a few of the other guys can remember it. And I says to Kenny, you know, can you imagine that? Souness in the hoops. And Kenny just said, well, listen, Paul, the move worked for him. He might never have made it in your team. And when you think about it, when you look at some of the talented players that didn't make it, you just never know. So it did work out for him. And I just didn't think I could ever imagine him in the green and white hoops. The other thing, again, going back to George, was his transfer to Manchester United. And it was Sean Fallon that told me that, and it was backed up by Tommy Docherty. And it came as a bigger surprise to George, because he found out when I interviewed him that, you know, United had made a record-breaking transfer bid for him, and Stephen pulled him. So there was a period of time there where Stephen still held the aces in terms of choosing whether or not a player went, and I think that was probably around about the time that Carey went. So that was a big surprise, not only to me but to George himself.
I mean, you see, there's loads of surprises. I mean, you know, from these kind of, you know, coming to see how late Sean left it, how close he was not to ever becoming a footballer at all. You know, in fact, he was in his late 20s before he left Sligo to go to Glenavon, you know, and we turned down Shelburne because he was a kind of a homebird, and all these kind of things, that how close he was to being a GAA player more than being a footballer. Then on to like transfers and things that could have happened, didn't happen, you know, why didn't they happen, all these things. I think the one point where my mouth was like hanging open was, you know, generally myself and Sean, but there'd be family, you know, Maya would be in, sometimes some of the sons and daughters would be around. There was one time, it was Chris Shevlin's son's wife, Sinead. She was in, and she said, "Have you told him about the time you went over to see the IRA?" And so I was, and he said, "Oh yeah, I suppose I should mention that." And it was that, you know, there'd been some, you know, reported threat against Celtic Park. He went over, he said, "Hey, you know, put in some calls, went over with Desmond White to meet with the guys, you know, these guys in the IRA," and you know, I'm saying, you know, you just literally, I couldn't even think of another question to ask him about it, you know. It was kind of, so you're just kind of looking, and he said, "Oh, it's all nonsense anyway," you know, like, but he said, you know, Desmond was doing an impression of Desmond White's, you know, leg shaking and everything, and said he was white. But that was one moment you just think, that's definitely a story, you know. Some things you think, I maybe half heard that. That was one story I've 100% never heard before, and it was just one that stopped you in your tracks, you know. There's a few where I was completely taken aback, but that was the one where I was, I just did not see coming in any way, shape or form at all.
Right, thanks guys. Plus, what we're going to do is we'll have a wee break for about 10-15 minutes, get yourself a drink at the bar, and then we can buy, we'll try and open it up so that if anybody's got any questions, just hand up, and we'll just try and answer as many questions and some more fascinating stories. So we'll see you back here in about 10 minutes. Thanks.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed the audio from the event of Thursday the 19th of November at the Admiral Bar with the authors. And as I say, part B will be along very, very shortly. Anyway, enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady, saying, now don't forget the Celtic FC Foundation are looking for bucket volunteers for the game on the 5th of December. If you're interested, contact the Celtic FC Foundation. I think they've got quite a few volunteers, looking for about 120 in total. So if you're interested, contact. If not, get your change ready for that game. Anyway, enough of me. This is me, Harry Beery, saying God bless and good night. Good night. Way down the lane away.
All shadowy lined, and the droning engine throbs in time with your beating heart. And the sun drips down, bedding heavy behind the front of your dress. All shadowy lined, and the droning engine throbs in time with your beating heart. Sing. In time with your beating heart.